Welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. I'm your host, Wendy Whittaker-Large, and I'm here to help you create a profitable HMO portfolio. Whether you're a brand new investor or you've been at it for a number of years, my podcast is here to help you make the most from your business, whether that is starting up, scaling, or systemizing. Please hit the subscribe button to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you've got an awe-inspiring project, an inspirational investing story, or a unique approach to HMOs, I'd love to hear from you. Good morning. This is Wendy Whittaker-Large, the host of the HMO Success Podcast. And this is episode 69. 69. Yes. I'm nearly as old as that. Not quite. Sometimes I feel as old as that, but I'm not yet there. So we have got some fantastic stories, interviews, case studies, topics that we've covered over the last couple of years since I've been running the podcast. And I'm as enthusiastic as ever as sharing the message with you about HMOs, how to create a profitable HMO enterprise, which is what I'm all about, helping you create a profitable HMO business. So all the guests that I have on my podcast either are involved in HMOs in one way or another, or they've invested in HMOs. Maybe they're doing other things now, but I love to share their stories with you. And today I'm absolutely thrilled to have a very special guest on the podcast. He's a good, very, very good friend of mine. We met a few years ago at a property networking meeting and we've remained close friends ever since. It is Paul Lanvier. So hi, Paul.
Hi, Wendy. It is with absolute delight that I join you today. You know how much I respect both you and your work. And so, yeah, it's a genuine pleasure to come and have a chat with you, and hopefully we can help the good listeners of your podcast out and set them on the right path.
Absolutely. So Paul, let me tell other people who haven't heard about you, how they haven't heard about you, I don't know, but a bit of background on you. You started in law. In fact, you obtained a first-class law degree and started your professional life as a barrister, later qualifying as a solicitor, practicing in commercial banking and finance litigation for 10 years, both in London and Leeds, which is very exciting. And you work for two of the world's leading law firms. Now, you did all of this before you led a demanding qualification program for prospective barristers. So you've been in the kind of education field in a slightly different industry before coming into property. Then you met your good lady wife, started a family, and you've had some amazing adventures actually with your family, as we've been following. If anyone follows you on social media, they'll know about some of the things you've been doing. We'll perhaps go on to talk about some of that too. You are an award-winning property entrepreneur, you're an investor, you're a developer, and a multiple business owner. And nowadays you're focused on mentoring, family, and surfing. And we don't mean surfing the web. We're talking about real waves here, aren't we?
Very much so. Very much so.
So
That very generous introduction.
Well, I'm hoping, Paul, that we can kind of cover some of those topics. I'm particularly interested to hear what you're doing with your time. Mm-hmm. And obviously, since getting involved in property, you've also expanded into other areas of investment. I know you're very interested in the world of money, the world of the money market. So we're going to spend a bit of time talking about that today as well, because clearly that is the macro picture that affects all of us if we're investing in property. But let me just start by kind of going back a little bit, if you don't mind, in your history. Yep. How did it all begin with property? Where did it all begin?
Okay, well, I'll just take us a few chapters back further than that, just so that you can kind of see how the destination arrived. But I'll take it very briefly. So, like, my first chosen career, as you know, a few people who know me know, was basically to be the rhythm guitarist in the band Metallica. Now, unfortunately, Metallica already has a more than capable frontman rhythm guitarist in the name of James Hetfield. So I had to really kind of think about, like, well, what is plan B? And I've been working on plan B ever since that. So I was about kind of 16 onwards. I accidentally ended up studying law as an A-level, purely by accident. I actually wanted to study politics. There was a timetable clash and they said, you can't do politics, but would you be interested in doing law? Go on then, let's give it a go. Had the most amazing teacher. So massive shout out to him, John Stacey Hibbert, if you're still on this mortal plane, like just the most real old school raconteur, just the sweetest guy. Like, just really, I've had many, many of those in my life. I've been very, very blessed. You know, I've stood on the shoulders of giants, you know, for as long as I can ever remember. And he was one of those giants. Did dreadfully at school. So I'm dyslexic, really struggled with school, didn't really enjoy the environment, really into music, really into girls. Not the combination that you need when you're trying to complete your GCSEs and A-levels and all the rest of it. There's that. Went off to uni. On my first day at uni, I bumped into a guy called Eddie, who later became a really good friend of mine. He was from down south, you know, sort of on the southeast coast. And he gave me my first really painful kind of reality check of life. He said to me, "Look, Paul, I know you were like interested in this barristery thing, but just so you know, you're never going to make it. You're never going to make it because you don't have any money. You're not from that kind of family. Your qualifications so far are really weak. Give up now, mate." And in saying that, he wasn't actually being unkind. He was actually trying to like do it through kindness. But my response to him, I won't repeat it exactly on the podcast, was, "Forget you, Eddie," or words to that effect. And cut a long story short, got a first class honours degree in law, was very fortunate to get various legal positions, did that for basically a decade. I always say of people, like, when I left the law, it was no great loss to the law, let's put it that way. I worked with some phenomenal lawyers who I have unlimited amount of respect for. I was not one of them, you know, I was not one of them. But then really life began to make much more sense when I was standing in the queue of a nightclub, which is not what you would anticipate. And there was this really, this absolutely like phenomenal woman standing in front of me in the nightclub. And I thought, and I turned around to my friend and I said, "Leave this to me, gentlemen." And I tapped her on the shoulder and I said, "You know, excuse me, is it worth us coming in this nightclub?" I'm not quite sure what I meant by that. But anyway, and she looked at me and gave me this cold, hard stare. She said, "No, I don't think it is." And like a retractable, you know, a couple of years later, you know, we're married, we've got our first child, and we've, you know, been happily married ever since. So that's how I met the lovely Liz Lamphere. How I got into property then. So Liz has been investing in property since 2000. And, you know, she did it back in the day when there were no courses, no influencers, you know, and, you know, she did it as a single woman in an environment that at that time, you know, was very, very heavily male dominated, like orders of magnitude different to what it is now. You know, she would describe that you literally couldn't get a refurb done. You know, they would just not return your call or not take you. Anyway.
Well, I mean, actually, just to mention that that was exactly my experience, because I started investing in 1996 and I was obviously a young woman. Well, I mean, I was really just a toddler at that age.
Yeah.
No, actually, I was old enough to invest in 1996. And I remember going to an auction in the northwest near Liverpool. I think it was at Haydock Race Park, and it was, I don't know, Graham Penny Auctions or one of these Northwestern auctioneers. Mm-hmm. And the room was full of men. I think I was the only woman in the room. I was incredibly intimidated. And I bought two properties at that auction. And I remember all eyes in the room turning to look at me as I lifted my card to bid. And I was shaking like anything. Mm-hmm. I think it was a mixture of nerves and adrenaline. But it was because I felt so on edge being the only woman in the room. And I'm very pleased to see that the industry has, you know, developed much more of a female leaning. We're still not there yet. I still write when I see a panel of property investors speaking at an event and there are no women on the panel, I always write a very friendly note to the organizer to say it would be very nice to see a female on this panel. Mm-hmm. Whether they listen to me, I don't know. But I think it's very important to hear the woman's voice because it's slightly different from the man's voice when it comes to property.
Definitely.
But good for Liz. Good for Liz. Yeah. And you married such a woman. Oh, good for you, Paul.
Well, woo! You know, and so a point then came where, you know, she was, I was like fully focused on the lawyering, like pretty stressed out, working a lot of hours, didn't have headspace for anything. She'd try and engage me in the property And I was just very, very resistant. So she's taking to my house on a Saturday morning. I was like, I do not want to be here. I want us to go for brunch. I want us to have a day off. That's it. But then, you know, she's very persuasive. And she, I was, you know, I went to New York for a while. I went to work out in Asia for a while, which meant I lived expense, like had no zero expenses, got a bonus, came back to the UK. She'd sold my car while I was away. Anyway, I won't dwell on that. That's a sore subject in my mind. But basically, she would take all the capital that I could accumulate and she would put it into financial assets. And this was at a time where I just had no awareness, you know, so I was just like, yes, that's the best thing for you to do. I shall focus on my career. And then the financial, so we were buying together as JV partners in a sense. I was providing the capital. I was doing the angel bit, if you like, and she was doing the work. And then the financial crisis hit and had, you know, obviously a really profound impact on the world. I was in legal practice. I saw it from a different perspective, which I'm happy to share about as well. And then as we emerged from the financial crisis, she said to me, look, I really want to go again. You know, I think there's some real opportunity here. And, you know, things were still pretty dark at that point. She says, no, I think there's opportunity here. You know, let's go again. But I don't want to do it on my own. I want you to run the business. I'll do the property, but you handle the whole of the business side of things. I was like, suits me. I'm not massively massively into bricks and mortar and all that, but I am interested in, you know, running a decent business with a decent set of accounts. Turns out that I happen to be very skillful in raising money, and I enjoy that aspect of it. And I am, you know, I have strong, meaningful relationships with all our investors. So that's what we did. And we, you know, we kind of took on some training. Some of it was great. Some of it was woeful. And then we really kind of dropped the hammer. And, you know, we spent 5 years where we didn't know what our names were, working 7 days a week, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, not because we wanted to do any work, but because we were just so anxious, you know, and that's how the empire was built.
Brilliant, brilliant. So you have based your family now in Leeds. You live near Leeds, don't you?
Yeah.
And your property portfolio is mostly based in that area too. Is that correct?
Yeah. And this, you know, all kudos to Liz on this. So she has very, very strong opinions on this. You know, that we should only invest really within an hour's walk, not drive, an hour's walk of our front door. And that has, you know, that has served us really, really well. Now, I know that that isn't always possible for people, but I would say if you could modulate your strategy to make that a viable proposition, I would do that. I would change the strategy and keep the location in a way. And if I give you an example of that, you know, we're a highly leveraged business from the perspective of we have really, really talented people doing the work. Like, they're much more talented, certainly, than me. But there are some situations which seem to be, you just hit a crunch point, and it isn't, alas, it's not sold in the brochure of property investment. So I'll give you an example. You know, we had a 6-bed HMO. We inherited it with a Saniflow, which, for people who don't know what Saniflow is, typically in a basement, if you can't get the plumbing right, you have to put in one of these, what some people call a floating toilet, which basically means the human waste goes into a macerator. So it's a machine that has lots of teeth and it liquidizes the human waste and shoots it down a very, very small pipe, there being the problem. and they're great. Like, they're really great for what the problem, for the problem they solve. But with all things in life, you can't defeat human nature. Not human nature. You can't defeat Mother Nature, is what I mean. And so we had a very, very specific, unusual, very difficult to identify problem with a HMO, which I won't bore you with. But the net result of it is that, you know, the basement at one point had human waste up to about, you know, above ankle height. And it, you know, I'm not going to go into the details because people might be eating breakfast, and I was stood there in my wellies, and I remember thinking to myself, this is not what I signed up for. This is not in the brochure. I'd like all my money back now, if that's okay. But I was able to stand shoulder to shoulder with, like, my most trusted person in Leeds. You know, he'd been doing property for like donkey's years, absolutely donkey's years. And I said, mate, we have to work out what's going on because I've had 20 people here and nobody can work it out, you know. And he knows the weird and wonderful things, how houses work, how water moves around a house, which was beyond me. And we had a good poke around. It's pretty unpleasant. And he said, you know what? It's not this. It's this. What's happening over here is forcing the water back through the system. And basically the only way it can get out is to come out through your Saniflow. So we solved that problem. So what's the moral of that story? Well, one, don't buy the brochure. Two, make sure you've got a pair of wellies, I suppose. But more, I suppose, three is sometimes it's really challenging to identify what's really going on in a site. And sometimes you have to go on your, you know, there, take a, you know, qualified member of the team, and do the problem solving. If you're very, very, very remote, I don't know how you'd overcome that, unfortunately.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, Paul, because I think that, you know, one of the things I've learned in business, and I think this is also about growth in your own mindset as a property investor. When you first start out, you've got a mixture of excitement and hopefulness and purpose. And, you know, the first property you ever buy, there's a tinge of fear, but there's also this tremendous sense that this is a new path. This is potentially going to lead to a new life. Like you say, the brochure, what does the brochure say? And that's kind of what the brochure says. But as you go on, what you realize is the biggest aspect of what you're doing, actually, whether you're running a property business or any other kind of business, is you're solving problems. Mm-hmm. And I think when a problem comes up nowadays, I used to kind of dread it. I used to kind of have a feeling in the pit of my stomach, oh no, such and such a thing has gone wrong. Oh no, this is a problem. Oh no, you know, three tenants have moved out. Oh no. And now I can't say that I completely feel wonderful when those things happen, but I take the approach that actually my role as leader, as director, as, you know, visionary, if you like, in the business, is to solve problems. And we as a team have to solve problems, because the more problems we solve, the more money we make. Mm-hmm. And for me, that aspect of being able to be a problem solver, it requires a bit of shift in thinking. Mm-hmm. Because to start with, you believe you are going to be, you know, it's a passive investment that's just going to give you, you know, £1,000 per month, bingo, off to the next project. Mm-hmm. But it's just not as simple as that when it comes to the day to day. So having that mentality, I think, is really, really important. So that project, that was a 6-bed HMO. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you had some problems that you had to solve within that project and you did them. I'd love to hear about a project that you're particularly fond of, or you have very, very good memories or feelings of, because it went really well, or the result was better than you could have expected. Can you pull one out of your memory, Paul, of, you know, a deal that you've done or a project that you've done where you felt this was just an amazing project, and tell us about it?
So I did a project which I'm particularly proud of, was a auction purchase. We bought a disused hostel. I think everybody in Leeds had a look at it at one point or another, and for some, you know, smarter investors than us had kind of decided they weren't going to bid on it and all the rest of it. So we bought a disused hostel in Leeds. We had to go through full planning. We had to take it back to brick, and then we had to create an extraordinary place to live. And there were so many nuances and twists and turns on it that, you know, it was just a really just a genuinely fascinating project. So just from a logistical point of view, you know, we went into the attic, we created dormers. It was originally two houses, then it was made into one hostel. We brought it back into two houses for reasons I'll explain in a minute. We did the basement, you know, so we did the whole tanking process of the basement, design a kitchen. So the end product was just unbelievably phenomenal. It was 2 6-beds, all en suite, beautifully designed, huge amounts of space. I think other investors would have probably doubled the number of rooms and all the rest of it. And people were trying to encourage us to do that and all the rest of it. But they're like enormous rooms, all en suites, absolutely phenomenal. The kind of place I'd let my own daughter rent. Designer kitchens, absolutely fabulous. You know, the lights turn on and off as you move around the house. It had hotel style Wi-Fi, so on every floor there was a brand new hot signal coming for you, and they had ether ports in each of the rooms, so if, you know, somebody needed to be hardwired in, and obviously this was pre-COVID, they were absolutely laughing. So that was the project. really, it was a great thrill to the project. Really enjoyed it. Not without its challenges, like every challenge in the sun presented itself. Having to go for planning, have to wait for planning. We didn't commence the work. There was a lot of pressure on us to commence the work before we had the planning. And I was pretty resolute. I said, look, if this doesn't get planning, this is going back in the auction, guys. So don't make a mess. We had to go through licensing, which is challenging in Leeds for a lot of different reasons. And obviously, you know, there's all the money to sort out as well, isn't it? So it's a great, absolutely great project. Round the back, it had this beautiful kind of shared garden area. It had bike racks. It had like secure bike storage and all the rest of it. Yeah, definitely as a project, I'd say like 10 out of 10, really happy with how it was delivered.
Amazing, amazing. So you do sound, as you speak about it, I can see the animation in your face that the you know, what it brings to mind is a project you're proud of. And it, I think to a certain degree, those kind of projects also set the standard, don't they? What you do a project like that, it turns out well, and you think, right, this is what we can achieve, this is what we're capable of. And of course, over the years, starting with Liz to now, you have built a sizable property portfolio. Mm-hmm. But I'm also really interested to know about some of your other areas that you're interested in investing, because I know, Paul, you have a much wider knowledge and a much wider education than just property. So can you tell us a bit more? Again, you don't have to go into detail, but what other kind of asset classes, what other things do you invest in and you're interested in?
Definitely. Before we go into that, which I'm happy to, we'll go straight into that. I feel like in the interest of like full disclosure, I should make a transparent disclosure at this stage. I have fairly recently sold that asset. And, you know, it's a high cash flowing asset and all the rest of it. The background to that is that somebody made me an offer for it.
You couldn't refuse.
Yeah. And I was very impressed by impressed by the offer. But lo and behold, could they put their money where their mouth is? They couldn't. But it set us that, because at that point then I had it valued by a number of estate agents in order to just sense check this offer, which you know, turns out to have not been a credible offer, as so many of them are, unfortunately. You know, I then kind of got into conversations with these estate agents who were like, you know what, I really, really know that we can get this away. And obviously we'd add a lot of value and it was the right thing to do in that sense. And we perhaps come onto this later, but like, if you really want to know what people think, ask them directly in private what they're doing with their own money. That tells you everything. That tells you everything. Anyway, so, you ask a good question about other assets. So in about 2018, I was always moving in 100% property circles. So everybody was just all in property all of the time. And very often they were like more like 120% in. They weren't just 100% in. And I just started getting really interested in other asset classes. So, you know, I started reading different books, and one book will lead to another, won't it? And different authors like kind of connect you to different people. So I started getting exposure to the like of Jim Rogers, one of the greatest investors of all time, has written a really beautiful book, which is called A Gift to My Children. Unfortunately, it's a very expensive book because it's not heavily printed, but it's a really beautiful book. He led me onto the likes of Stanley Druckenmiller, again, one of the greatest investors to walk the face of the planet. And he's got there's so much we can learn from him about where we're at today. He tells this amazing story about going to Africa. You know, he says, like, if you don't know what to do right now, don't do anything. Like, go to Africa. And there's, you know, that served us well. I can say that. And then, you know, people like Paul Tudor Jones, the greatest trader ever to walk the planet, made an absolute fortune in the 80s crash. You just listen to these different people and they open a whole new world. And then I suppose the place I ended up in terms of meaningful research is the likes of Ray Dalio. So Ray Dalio, greatest hedge fund manager in the world. You know, his work, his books, the greatest resource you could tap into right now would be a fairly short video on YouTube, The Changing World Order by Ray Dalio. It will put what is going on in the world in complete context. And I think, probably the best single resource currently available on the internet, I would say.
The other person I would put into that bucket is Jim Rickards. Mm. Have you come across Jim Rickards as well? Yeah, I think he's tremendous as well.
I think, so I've read all of Jim's books, absolutely love his books. I think you, for some time, I think as a grown adult with a reasonable level of maturity, what we're able to do is we're able to separate a person's work from their politics, for example. So you may not resonate with an author, the entirety of a person, an author's politics, but that doesn't mean that they haven't got a great mind. You know, so Jim Rickards, for example, is famously a Trump supporter. But, you know, if you find that repellent, don't dismiss his books. Like, the guy still has written some really fabulous books. So that's kind of the where I got into. And then obviously going deeper into Ray Dalio's work around diversification, you know, from 2018, we have aggressively diversified from property. So still we have a significant amount of our net worth in property, but we also have a whole range of diversified assets that I'm not going to say is perfect, but it's weathered the storm of COVID and everything else that's going on, really well. It's some of it's outperformed property. So I'm a great believer in diversification. I think the only footnote to that is cash flow is always king. Yes. So I wouldn't think about any form of diversification until cash flow. You've absolutely nailed cash flow, and that's never ever been more important than today. Cash flow is absolutely king. Do not let anybody persuade you any different. Cash flow is absolutely king.
Yes, I completely agree. In fact, I was having a discussion with my dad and my sister yesterday about property, and my dad was saying, you know, surely it's a good thing for you that inflation is where it is, because it's going to increase the value of your property portfolio. And I said, Dad, with respect, that might look good on paper, it looks good on the company balance sheet, but frankly, it makes absolutely no difference to my day-to-day life. What I'm interested in my day-to-day life is, can I increase the cash flow as a result of that? Mm-hmm. And yes, we know that there will be, because of inflationary pressures, rents will go up. We've certainly put our rents up this year, but actually capital growth on its own is meaningless for me. That is absolutely not why I invest for capital growth. And of course, investing in the North, we've seen much more insipid capital growth than people have in the South over the last 10 years. So that's never been part of our strategy. It's cash flow. And I think you're absolutely right. When mm-hmm. you get your cash flow sorted and you've got that, and you keep an eye on that, that needs to be the number one priority, to get your cash flow to the level where you want it to be and need it to be, and you can grow it. Then you can do all these other wonderful things. So that's definitely really very, very good sound advice, Paul. Can I ask you, therefore, about your knowledge, therefore, about the wider financial markets, clearly other diversified assets that you yourself invest in and you've educated yourself about? Before we came on the podcast, you and I sort of exchanged a couple of messages. And clearly, at the moment, we're in some very turbulent times, not just in the UK, but across the world. The global economy is shaking. And we see this in many different indications. What I'd love to do is to understand from you what your take on that is today, and how people can react to that, how they might choose to react to that, because we can all choose how we react. And with your insight, what can you tell us about what's happening? But also, I'd like to think back to 2008, mm-hmm. because we had a global financial crisis then, as we are potentially having now, although in a slightly different manner, it's happening now, although that's not to say it won't suddenly collapse in on us at some point. Could you talk us through your thoughts on that, Paul, please?
So I think a really good resource to lean into is, as I say, like Ray Dalio's work around the long-term debt cycle and where we are, you know, that we are at a stage where it's the end of the American empire, or certainly into its kind of final innings. And empires have come and gone. You know, it's fascinating to learn about how prolific the Dutch empire was, for example. I was unaware of how prolific, you know, the Dutch were. And obviously we've got a fair understanding of the British empire. And then obviously, as we move on to America.
And prior to that, the Spanish,
Like, fascinating, isn't it?
Global. Yes, yes, quite.
So we're in this final moment, in the final moments of the kind of American empire, if you like. And that doesn't mean that the US is going to disappear off the face of the planet. Absolutely not. You know, it has a long, vibrant future in front of it. I'm sure it does. But what it does mean is that other powers are going to take a more prominent role, and they will have their own rules and they'll have their own world outlook. China, India, and obviously to a lesser extent, but not to at all be overlooked, is the role that Russia will play in this as one of the most heavily commodity rich countries on the face of the planet. So I think that's the context. I don't personally believe that it is all doom and gloom. An interesting book to read is a book called The Fourth Turning. Have you come across The Fourth Turning?
Yes, yes, I have.
So that makes a really good, interesting read. So the only health warning it comes with is if you absolutely loathe American history, you can find the first few chapters really tedious. But like, you just have to get over it. Like, you just have to get over it. The last three chapters are where it all lies, and it's worth rereading the last three chapters. And I reread them probably every quarter. And it helps us to understand why the world is beginning to go the way it is. And to kind of steal the punchline of the book, it is largely because a generation lasts roughly 80 years. All of the people who had firsthand experience of the brutalities and insanity of combat, of war, i.e. the Second World War, for example, they are sadly no longer with us. And we as a population have effectively forgotten how traumatic that as an experience was. And, you know, we're almost being called upon to be reminded of it now because we've forgotten what the horrors of war really mean. And what that's also meaning is that the institutions that were born out of the last crisis, people have failing confidence in, rightly or wrongly. And you can see it across our society, can't you? People are very, very skeptical now. They're politicians, the media, the police, even the health service. And I'm certainly not going to kind of go down a rabbit hole and justify any of that. It's just an observation, isn't it, that confidence is at an all-time low in some of these key institutions that we need. And like, let's not make any bones about it. We need these institutions. You know, when I was a trainee barrister and I was sitting opposite murderers, rapists and paedophiles, you do not want these people to go unchecked. Like, you don't want them near you. You don't want them near your family. You need institutions that address the challenges that society presents. So I think that's the context that we are in. In terms of where we go next, we are going to see we are going to have a turbulent few years, I think. There's plenty that we can do to counter all of that. I do, however, think the future is very bright. So I've got a young daughter. I have never been more excited about the opportunities on this planet for her. The planet is in really safe hands with the generation that she is part of. All we need to do is just be good stewards for the next few years and hand it over to them. All will be well.
Well, Paul, that's a very positive outlook.
And I genuinely believe that, you know, I genuinely believe that.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear. What is your take on fiat currency? That's a big question, isn't it, for Thursday morning?
Yeah, so I think it's worth just understanding what that is. So fiat currency is a currency effectively by decree. It is a government turning to its people and saying, this is what you have to use in order to transact, in particular, how you have to pay your taxes. Just so you know, if you don't pay your taxes, we will use violence against you. We will put you in prison. That's to be understood, isn't it? The challenge with fiat currencies is that really, money and the state shouldn't be one. The state cannot be trusted to look after the money because it will use it for its own purposes. You know, there's some really fascinating books on the subject, really fascinating books on the subject that do some really clever analysis. You know, they take you right back and they say, look, how did wars used to be when we had hard money, real money? How did wars used to be fought? Well, one army would turn up on one side of the hill, the other would turn the other. They wouldn't even send all of the troops into battle. So they would send a certain amount of the troops into battle and they would see what happens. And during the course of the conflict, one side may capitulate to the other, because they don't want their whole army murdered on the battlefield. But why are there such constraints? Because they don't have an unlimited number of soldiers. They don't have an unlimited amount of resources. They don't have an unlimited amount of money. But if the state owns the money and it can produce as much of it as it likes, it has that this completely unfettered, unfettered. There's nothing to control its excesses, basically.
Yes.
There are some really fascinating books on this. A really interesting one, and this isn't in any way a buy signal or promotion or endorsement in any way for Bitcoin, but there is a really fascinating book written by a UK-based author called Dominic Frisby, and he has written a lovely book called The Future of Money. And obviously within the book, he references Bitcoin because that's his choice. But the first few chapters of that book are such an elegant explanation of how money arose. And I mean, you'll be really familiar with it, so I'm not going to kind of repeat it. But, you know, whether they're circular stones on an island, or shells, or shiny beads, or eventually the precious metals, or then credit and all the rest of it. It's worth, I think, all humans, if I can put it that way, in knowing what money really is. My having invested an enormous amount of time in studying the subject made me an exponentially better investor.
Yes, and I think that's really true, that you might start off investing in property. You might start investing a couple of single buy to lets because you think that's a good home for your money. You look at the charts, you can see how a property generally keeps up with inflation. It's a good kind of hedge against currency devaluation. And you think maybe about your pension or about having a legacy for your children. Certainly that's how you get started. And that's how I got started. And then you might get into HMOs and you might do a portfolio of HMOs. So you get your cash flow sorted. So everything's, you know, fine. And then you find you've got a little bit of time and you start to think about money. Mm-hmm. And you start to go back to the grassroots of thinking, what is this substance that we all crave, that we all want, that we all need, that seems to cause political upheaval, that seems to cause financial upheaval? And right now in the world, we're seeing high inflation, high government debt. We're seeing growth being very insipid. If anything, we're teetering on the edge of recession, and we're seeing, you know, the cost of living rise for so many people because of the inflationary pressures. We've got the war in Ukraine, we've got energy at an all-time sort of restriction partly because of the war in Ukraine, but not by all means by the only reason. And we then have interest rates going up as well to pay for the cost of all the borrowing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people will be listening today and thinking, but as an HMO investor, mm-hmm. how does this affect me and what lessons can I learn and how should I react to it? So, you know, if you were going to give somebody some advice who's looking to invest in HMOs or currently is investing, maybe thinking about refinance, this macro world may seem slightly foreign to them. Mm-hmm. And yet you and I know, Paul, this is an incredibly important topic to understand, because actually taking a position on it gives you strength. It gives you knowledge. Mm-hmm. It gives you power mm-hmm. as an investor. Like you say, it's enabled you to make much wiser decisions in terms of investing. Mm-hmm. So somebody who's investing in HMOs, what would you say they should be mindful of as they go forward on that part of their investing portfolio?
So I think it's probably, if it's okay with you, Wendy, worthwhile making it specific to where we are in this point in time as well, actually, because many of us have been able to build portfolios on effectively free money in a rising market. And, you know, I remember telling Liz with great glee that I had just successfully refinanced property and got 100% of our money out of it. Aren't I clever? And she basically she said it with love, but she basically said, look, Paul, everybody's a genius in a rising market, aren't they? And it was like, well, yeah, true, very true. So the environment in which a lot of us have invested may not be the environment which is going to be present for, let's say, the next 18 to 24 months. Maybe it will. Like, you know, your crystal ball as good as mine. I think there's some fundamental lessons that Liz and I learned from, which we reflected on in a director's meeting a week or so ago. And the tone of the meeting was, it's so good we know what we know now going into what's about to happen. You know, a lot more relaxed. We can, you know, we can think clearly through all of this noise. So I think where we are economically is 2023 is likely to mark a recession. What does, you know, it's a recession. So two quarters of negative GDP growth. Obviously, there's going to be an impact on employment. Obviously, there's going to be an impact on people's discretionary spending, and be under no illusions of that. You know, I speak to people in other industries, and they say to me as a friend, they say, you haven't seen anything yet. You just wait till you see what's coming down the pipe, and because they work in other industries and they have access to all kinds of different data. So what's the first, I think, takeaway point? Cash is king. And what I mean by that is, you know, really, really good, decent, healthy cash reserves in any business going into an economic downturn, that's going to be absolutely your lifeboat. And we all have a different level of tolerance. So a friend of mine who went through the last recession, he says there's always a number. And what he means by that is there is a number in your bank account that once it goes below that number, you become very, very anxious and very, very fearful. And everybody has their number. So cash is king. Think about having reserves. And we're all very, very different in this respect. So if one of your mentees was to wisely turn to you for your counsel, Wendy, and say, well, look, how many months reserves do you think I should have? What would be a sort of standard answer in your world?
So I think a standard answer is normally six months cash reserve. Personally, I am more comfortable with a year. Yeah. At least a year. Yeah. Actually, now I want to do my calculations on my business and my property portfolio based on 70% occupancy, mm-hmm. or rather what I should say, 70% paid occupancy. Yeah. Because what we also know is when we go into a downturn, you may have tenants in your HMO who are living there but not paying. Mm-hmm. So you've got to find a level at which this HMO is still going to wash its face. It's still going to be a workable project for you. And you've got to decide what that level is. I actually think for much of our portfolio, because we haven't over leveraged, we have been quite careful about how much we have leveraged the portfolio, that 50% would still be absolutely fine. We wouldn't be making much money, mm-hmm. but we could live on that. So I think that people have to do the maths based on ensuring that their costs, their outgoings are going to be met by a certain level of occupancy, paid occupancy in the HMO. So that would be one of the things I would say, is that you need to be doing analysis. Mm-hmm. I think you also need to be shopping around for utility providers, being clever, educating tenants about energy usage, because that's obviously a very big hit. Mortgage products, whether you actually need to leverage and take all your money out, mm-hmm. you know, that's another thing. Is this a good time to be doing all those 100% refinances, or maybe this is a good time to actually hold back a little bit and leave a bit more money in the deal for the short term, while this potential tsunami, which is what it potentially could be, hits the fan, mm-hmm. and we have to kind of get through it. And if in a few years' time, I think things will settle down again. But I think we are going to go through some very, very big turbulence.
I agree.
So
I agree with that. And I think those benchmarks all definitely make sense, and they're all entirely personal choices. I feel like my inner lawyer now requires me to say none of this is financial advice and all the rest of it.
It's just our opinion.
And I think we're all very, very, there's a lot of nuance which is lost. So the problem with, for example, social media is there's no nuance. Like, really, nobody can give you advice. You need to understand what your own financial circumstances are. So, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, like, we've been selling into strength for the last year, you know, so we've been raising enormous amounts of cash. But that's because that's where we are in our cycle, and that we are optimized for other things. So we are not currently optimizing for growth. Give me 6-12 months, I don't know, maybe I will be optimized for growth, but I'm optimized currently for other things right now. Worth, just without wanting to labor the point too much, you know, this whole narrative about, you know, cash is trash, You know, Ray Dalio has recently changed his position on that, and he's been public on it. He says, no, cash is no longer trash. With interest rates where they are now, with inflation hopefully coming down, cash is a viable asset. But remember, he's not speaking to the man in the street. He's speaking to an institutional investor who has billions to deploy. He's not talking, you know, to the person walking down the street. And if you see some of his, which seem to be less publicized stuff on YouTube, when he's talking about, you know, what would you say to a millennial? He's saying, develop really high value skills, live within your means, be cash flow positive, and be a cooperative human being. And you can't be that. That's good advice.
Yeah, it is good advice. I think the other thing is, of course, that the dollar has been performing particularly well. It's very strong for various different structural reasons as well, which I'm not going to go into today because it's not for me to say. But, you know, the dollar is strong, so I can understand why he would say that. I think with a weaker currency, his position may well change somewhat. But I'd like to actually just kind of bridge back to 2008 because, you know, with the education you've done and the thinking you've done, the reflection you've done, you've got some learnings for us about 2008 that we can apply to these times. So, Paul, let's hear your words of wisdom from the global financial crisis as to what we can learn today.
Okay, so a lot of us want to be heroes. Okay, so a lot of us want to buy the dip. A lot of us think that we're going to be able to do that. That when there is literal blood on the streets and there's a version of that saying that says buy when there's blood on the streets, including when it's your own blood, you know, that's it. One of the great revelations that I think is a great revelation that may be common knowledge, but when you want to buy when there's blood on the streets, liquidity may not be waiting for you. And what I mean by that is, like, you may not find there's anybody who wants to lend you the money to buy the dip. And if it's really grisly, the rates at which the price of money may be astronomically high. I mean, that was one of the challenges in the last financial crisis, is that people were on floating rates, basically. So they were at the mercy of changing interest rates. And those interest rates were absolutely crucifying their cash flow. So good, profitable businesses were going from highly cash flow to zero cash flow. So if you want to buy, if you are serious about buying the dip, you need to get your war chest together, and you need to start doing that now. You know, I would say you need to start doing it in the new year. You need to just work out what the available lines of credit that you're able to secure for the position you're in. And also look at your other available lines of credit. When things get really, really grisly, for example, you won't be able to get a 0% credit card. So if you don't have a 0% credit card, and you wish to have a credit card and you feel like you could use it responsibly, you kind of need to plan that down the road. If you work with investors, you need to be talking to your investors well ahead of the game. You really need to be in, just sense checking where they're at, what their family life is like, what their aspirations are, how they feel about the market. You need to be putting in that work now. So basically, line up your war chest. Do not leave it until you need it, until you desperately need it. I think also, if you're not all assets are equal. So, for example, if you already have an asset on a street and you know all the problems with that street and you know all the good things on that street, one of the things that worked out really well for us was to buy additional properties on the same street because it's so heavily de-risked. You know exactly how the asset performs. You know exactly what happens on that street. That's really, really stood us like the absolute test of time. So build your war chest. Cash is king. Build your war chest. Not all other assets. Not all assets are equal. And then the final thing I'll share with you, happy to delve into other areas as well if you wish, is really, really block out the noise. So what I specifically mean by that is that everybody's circumstances are completely unique. You are a unique human being. Nobody else has the set of circumstances that you do. You are a genuinely unique human being. So when you're hearing people talk about their investment decisions, you do not know the full context with which they're speaking. So, for example, let's say somebody says to you, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. You should be absolutely filling your boots. or somebody says, are you crazy? You shouldn't be buying a single thing. You don't know why, what their circumstances are. So let's pick two completely contrasting examples. You might have somebody who effectively works for a fund and they've got millions of pounds to deploy. Their job is effectively to buy one property a week for a fixed period of time that meet broadly these criteria. That's their job. So if they stop buying, they've broken that, they've breached their mandate to their client, and you know they're not doing their job. Contrast that with somebody who has many, you know, has an enormous portfolio of houses. They've been doing it for a long time. They are financially free many, many times over. And actually, they're looking at projects that they've offered on. They've said, actually, do you know what? Now I've sharpened my pencil. Now I've factored in new rates. Actually, do you know what? I'm going to take that. They haven't accepted my offer, so I'm going to withdraw my offer. I'm withdrawing all of my offers. Do you see how contrasting those are? But if you don't, if you don't know the context, you can really misinterpret what's going on. The first person just has a different. They're not good or bad. They just have a different job to do. The second person is not good or bad, less smart, more intelligent. It's just they have a different perspective. You know, they've made it, so they can. You know, they've sharpened the pencil. They've gone through the numbers. Said, you know what? I don't need to do this right now. Take my offers off the table. These things might be available in 6 months' time. I might buy them then. Or do you know what? I might not buy them at all because, you know, I don't have the sense of urgency that I did, for example, when I wanted to leave my job. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. In other words, everybody's context is different. And as an investor, you have to weigh up the context as much as the content. Mm-hmm. That the content of the investment strategy or opportunity needs to be weighed up within its context and whether that context is actually right for you as an individual. So I think those are amazing sage words, Paul. I think you could become the new sort of property philosopher. because I think that's really, really helpful for people to understand. And of course, in your own life, you started to utilize that and apply it. And being financially free, of course, has given you the time not only to explore some of these concepts, to think more deeply about it, to share them with the world, but also you have this amazing lifestyle with your camper van, you're traveling, and you're surfing. So before we finish today, because it's been really just so interesting to listen to you, I would love to know a bit more about your plans for your surfing. How good are you? I mean, I'm terrible at surfing. I've tried it a few times. I actually went on a family surfing holiday a few years ago. I could hardly stand up on the board. It's much harder than it looks. So can you do it, and how's that all going? And you know, in terms of what you want to do as a family, you know, you've been to some really interesting places, I'd love to find out how Millie has kind of how she embraces some of that experience as well, and what she makes of it all.
So a great question, which I ask myself. So I think there's a series of questions you can ask yourself, and I would do it. I do it to myself, and I do it to everybody around me when there are any kind of crossroads. Is this question of what is most important to you right now? What is most important to you right now? You can put it another way. It's like, what are you optimized for? And we're all in completely different stages of life. And I think the problem that exists, let's say, in the mentoring world is that the mentors with really strong personalities, let's say pick Grant Cardone, right? And I like Grant Cardone. He writes really interesting books. But what you'll notice is that like he has a very particular version of the world, and he has a particular message that he sends out. I actually saw him speak at an event a few years ago, and I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. He was really good. He was really entertaining. He was like your kind of the uncle that you wished you'd always had, that kind of thing. But people have like very, very dominant voices, and I think you can sometimes get pulled along with the kind of the Grant Cardone world, and maybe that's not where you're at. So for example, so it's like, what are you optimized now for? So a typical answer might be, I actually don't enjoy my job anymore. I used to enjoy my job. I actually don't enjoy it anymore. it's actually making me feel like less than well, you know. So it's like, okay, that's cool. So what we need to optimize for is you replacing your income as quickly as possible whilst remaining healthy and sane and all the rest of it. But so you're optimized for that. Okay, that's cool. But you could equally speak to somebody in the same room and they could tell you, Paul, I actually love my job. And actually, like, one part of the problem I have with the property space is they're always telling me to sack my boss. And it's like, I actually love my job and I'm really good at it. And I get to travel around the world and I love it. But I also know, you know, I can't do this forever. I cannot keep the pace. So I need assets back in the UK to look after me. So I can retire at some point. So I suppose it's that question of like, what's most important to you? What are you optimized for? So if you were to ask me that question now, you know, I've got a young family at home. And one of the great realizations you have is that we have a relatively limited amount of time with children at home. And then they'll go off into the wide world. And, you know, they mature pretty quickly as well. Even though my counsel is, I was always in a rush. Don't be in a rush. Like, it's all there waiting for you. Like, I don't know why I was in such a rush all the time. But anyway, but of course, it's up to them whether they would choose to listen. So I am specifically optimized for creating just absolutely world-class, phenomenal family adventures. So that's the mission, is these really extraordinary kind of family adventures. And obviously, we've had to put in a lot of groundwork in to do that. So we own all of our own intellectual property. We've repaid all of our investors. We own like 99% of our portfolio just in our own names, kind of outright. We have, you know, a couple of joint ventures, but they're kind of special ones that we keep for other reasons. So that's all created this lovely platform. And then obviously what we've done is we've got that lovely wide cash flow base and we've built other projects on top of it. So for example, my breakfast group and my mentoring and the other investments and other activities that we're involved in. So that's what we're optimizing for, these adventures. The last one was going to the Arctic Circle. So we traveled 3,000 miles. We in the camper, we surfed above the Arctic Circle multiple times. I mean, it's just unbelievably extraordinary.
Amazing, amazing. And how long did it take you to get there, to get to the Arctic Circle?
So we optimized by using ferries. So that's a real great, like, word to the wise. If you're doing a long distance overland kind of thing, is try and see what the ferries can do for you. Like, ferries are amazing. If you haven't been on a ferry for a few years, it's probably not the experience that you would anticipate, but they're a great opportunity, especially if you're really hammering the miles, is for everybody to kind of have a bit of a break. So yeah, so I mean, I think it was like five days pretty solid traveling on the way up, and then obviously we had the trip.
Was it Finland? Did you go to Finland?
No, so we went to the islands of Lofoten, which is an archipelago of islands. If you see a really extraordinary kind of scene of mountains in the Norwegian Sea, you're probably looking at a picture of Lofoten. And then we didn't go into Finland because obviously Finland is next to Russia. They've been
things going on.
Yeah, there's a few things going on, but I trust the Finnish people. You know, that, like, they know what they're doing. Let's put it that way. You know, the Finnish people have got this handled. They're used to their neighbour by this point. And then we drove back through Sweden, completely miscalculated Sweden. in terms of like had to do some crazy hours to do
Sweden is huge. We've been to Sweden in our motorhome, and we went to Malmo, and to go to Stockholm, we looked at the distance and we decided we would take the train. So we stayed in Malmo. We left the motorhome in Malmo for about 3 nights. We went to Stockholm. We stayed in a hotel in Stockholm for 3 days, but we went by train because it would have taken us 3 days to drive. It is the mm-hmm. biggest country that you completely underestimate how big it is, but it's phenomenal.
And loved Sweden. Like, absolutely worth it. Like, just it was so beautiful. The drivers are absolutely phenomenal. And all of our Scandinavian brothers and sisters are absolute pleasure to deal with, an absolute delight to travel with. And yeah, I had a real bucket list moment where, my daughter kind of paddled out in the sunset onto this Swedish lake and was kind of like, Dad, come in, let's go for a paddle. Had this kind of sunset paddle I mean, just
amazing.
Like, I fairly frequently have these moments where I think this is the best experience of my life. Yeah. I just want to really savor this moment because it cannot get any better than this. And then I'm always surprised that another one comes along fairly shortly thereafter.
And presumably that includes surfing, when you can get on the board and you can surf the wave. So tell me, Paul, come on, be honest with me. Just talking to Wendy, how good are you at surfing?
It's all down to getting a mentor. So I've always said, like, stand on the shoulders of giants. So when I was 14, trying to learn the guitar, I had a really, you know, good guitar teacher and all the rest of it, and Property and all the other things that I've done in my life since. And the same is true. So I have a really great surf mentor. Shout out to Coastal Concepts. And just amazing. A good surf trainer can get you upstanding in the first session if the conditions are viable. They just know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. And a good mentor can also read you pretty well, and they will know how far to stretch you and how far, you know, whether you're just there for fun or whether you do want to be pushed a little bit. I had a difficult surfing session a few months ago, and pretty much terrified myself, got myself into a little bit of a challenging situation. I wasn't going to die or anything, but my central nervous system didn't realize that. You know, it thought, this is it. You know, this guy's actually trying to kill us. So I obviously got to a place of safety and all worked out in the end. And then I had to fess up to my mentor over a text message and say, like, mate, I really, really scared myself. And he said, that's fine. I'll see you, you know, when should we meet? I thought, oh, I'll meet you Wednesday. And then he met me in this really unusual spot at a really unusual time with a really unusual tide. And I was like, what are we doing here? This isn't what we normally do. And he was like, I'd got myself stuck in a rip, which is a very, which is a strong current that takes you in a direction that you don't necessarily want to go in. And he was like, okay, so today we're going to ride the rip. And I was like, oh, wow, this sounds like fun. Not. And it was like, just, it was amazing. Like the waves were coming up these steps, and our job was to be halfway up the steps with our boards at head height and to jump off the steps onto it and then paddle like crazy through the rip. And the rip was take us out to sea. But, you know, this guy has been surfing since the day he was born. He has, he's trained in every aspect of water safety. And this guy has been surfing this point for as long as any of us have been eating breakfast. And it was just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. We got out and I was completely exhausted, and he said, how do you feel about it all now? I've never felt this good in my life. And he goes, well, that's good. So do you feel all right about, you know, getting back in the water and feel you understand how rips work and what to do, what not to do? I was like, yeah, I feel much more confident now, and I'm still responsible in my watercraft, but a good mentor can do that, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, as you say, standing on the shoulder of giants, standing on the shoulders of a surfboard also helps when you're trying to surf. And perhaps one day, Paul, you can give me a lesson and maybe I will learn surfing before I die.
I'm sure it's within your capabilities.
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think if we live nearer the sea, I would, I'm sure, take to it a bit more than living slightly too much inland. Listen, today has been really wonderful. Go on.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would say is definitely horses for courses. So it's like definitely not Liz's thing. So Liz's thing is a very, very different vibe. She enjoys her bike. She enjoys hiking. She loves the van. She loves reading. It's definitely horses for courses. And I think you just do whatever resonates for you. I mean, don't, for the love of God, allow me to persuade you to start down the road that you definitely don't want to do it. It's definitely horses for courses. I was brought up by the sea. I have a natural affinity with the ocean. It's for me, it's like a really healing place. So, and I am, you know, responsible in my attitude towards it.
Well, I think today has been a great exploration of doing what's right for you, discovering who you are as an individual, educating yourself. If you're interested in certain aspects of life, and in our case, it's investing, property and finance, that might not even be your thing. You might listen to this podcast and think, yeah, I'm not that interested, but I'm really interested to hear what Paul has to say about me becoming a fuller, better, more expressive version of myself. And you know, I think this interview today, Paul, has really given me an insight into you an insight that I didn't have before, and it's been really wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today. Also, I think it's been very inspiring to hear what you say about people choosing their own course, taking their own lives, being responsible, and deciding what's right for them, whether it's in investing or in the free time that they have. Mm-hmm. Choose something that floats your boat, that makes you smile, that gives you a high, whatever that might be, and do it well. And, you know, I think your life clearly, you know, shows that, exemplifies it, Paul. So thank you very, very much today. It's been a really wonderful interview, and I'm really, really grateful. And I know that my podcast listeners will equally enjoy listening to you.
It is an absolute pleasure, Wendy. I'm very grateful for you inviting me on.
Thank you for listening to the HMO Success Podcast. If you'd like to know more about how you can create a profitable HMO business, please visit our website, hmosuccess.co.uk, to find out more. We have plenty of free tools and information for you there, and also on our Facebook group, The Ultimate HMO Success System. We look forward to connecting with you very soon. Thanks for listening.